Hey everyone, welcome back to another Rewildology Nature Happy Hour. Or should I say Nature Coffee Hour? That's right, Charles and I switched things up for our end of the year chat and traded evening cocktails for morning beverages. And let me tell you, the vibe is different and so awesome. In this episode, we're closing out 2025 by catching up on everything that's happened this year. I share updates on Project Patagonia and tease the brand new Amazon series coming out next year. Charles talks about his health comeback, his growing lab at UGA, and some major research wins. But we also dive into the meaty stuff, wetland protections getting gutted in the US, incredible sea turtle comebacks, Ecuadorian communities taking mangrove conservation into their own hands, and the game-changing high seas treaty that just went into effect. Fair warning, we get a little philosophical somewhere around the 1 hour mark when I start processing some big feelings about humanity and interconnectedness. Blame it all on the Amazon interviews I've been doing, and Charles just rolls with it like the good friend he is. So grab your favorite beverage, coffee, tea, beer, water, whatever, and join us for this year-end reflection on conservation wins, losses, and what's got us fired up heading into 2026. Let's dive in. Well, I've hit the record button, so
great.
We're officially rolling.
Yeah, well, this is our first, in my mind, this is our first Nature Coffee Hour, right? The others have been happy hours. I don't think we've done any morning sessions before.
No, we haven't. This is our first coffee, but you have tea. Okay, our morning beverage.
Getting called out for my tea drinking habits here. Yeah, I have a wonderful jasmine tea from Yamamoto Yama, which is a really nice, I think, Japanese company that just, you can get imported nice teas from there.
Oh, nice. I have a nice light roast because I am kind of a coffee snob. And yeah, if you like dark roast, you're missing out. You got to go for the light roast. You got to go for the light roast.
I promise I'll get us back on topic at some point, but I actually don't know enough about coffee to know like why. What is the big difference?
Like, it's bitterness process. Level? So it's like there's more flavor. There's more acid. It's like stronger. It's like.
Okay.
Yeah.
More caffeine too?
I don't know, probably, because it's me. So probably there's more caffeine. I don't know. I like it a lot.
I didn't know that you were a coffee snob until I saw your French press just now. And then I was like,
do you mean my French press is going to make it through the zombie apocalypse?
Look at that thing. That's so intense. I mean, it's awesome. I always envy people's caffeinated drink infrastructure, right? Like just the cool objects that people have.
Oh my gosh, I went to a friend's and they were having like a housewarming party and he showed me this pour over contraption. It literally was over $200 for this coffee thing. And I was like, I thought I had a problem. I mean, a French press is as like low maintenance as it gets. I literally heat up water to a certain amount and you like do some kind of fancy things to make sure it tastes good. You don't burn it. But that's like it. No. This was a $200 contraption. And I was highly impressed. I was like, can you please make me a cup of coffee?
I was going to say
it's like 4 p.m.
Yeah. Did he make you coffee and was it absolutely fire?
No, there was way too many people. It was a big housewarming party, but I was just Tyler, holy crap. Like,
next
how
visit.
Much was this? Like, he's like, yeah, when I get obsessed, I get obsessed.
Some people go really hard. Yeah.
Like the burnings we were just talking about. Like the
yes,
burning.
Exactly. Bird watchers are a great example of that. I'm really into yerba mate, but I didn't want to be like too energetic for our conversation. So I took it easy on that this morning, but having like just the right temperature water, all that stuff.
Yeah. Mm. See, okay, you're a yerba mate snob. I'm
Light
roast coffee snob.
I'm an aspiring yerba mate snob. Probably slob too, but I don't think I'm quite at that level yet. I think I have to go spend some time in Argentina and like learn from the real snobs before I can like really take that title and roll with it. But I'm getting there.
Yeah.
So anyhow, I feel like this is going to be a more energetic. you know, sharper version of our happy hours, right? Like the happy hours are maybe different kind of energetic, maybe a little more, maybe a little more loosey goosey. I feel like this is going to be our focused.
Yes, because it's the beginning of the day, and we are have caffeine, not beverages, other beverages, and we didn't go through an entire work day and then sit down and record like we did previously. We both have very brain draining jobs. That's not a bad thing at all. It's just by the end of the day, you're like, I this is what I say. I was like, I can't word anymore. I was like, I can't word. I just like, I just forget a proper word. I'm like, sorry, I just can't word anymore. It's
I was really impressed listening to our last happy hour before this. Like,
we
were remarkably coherent.
Wow.
For that late at night. And of course, you know, part of the reason we're having a coffee hour. I mean, I love the idea of switching up every now and then, but part of the reason is, you know, I've got to travel this evening. We're right before the holidays here. So I appreciate you accommodating my schedule, and I'm excited to see how the vibe differs.
Yeah.
With a cozy caffeine.
Call it like nature
discussion.
Beverage hours, and it just doesn't have the same ring as nature happy hour, but it's the same vibe.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess depending on what time anybody's listening to this, grab your favorite beverage, you know,
whatever
it is. Maybe just water. It doesn't have to be caffeine or alcohol related. Just a beverage.
That's right. We're not telling anyone to make lifestyle choices here. So, so in the interest of kicking things off a bit, what is one thing you'd like to share then from the past year, now that we are rounding out 2025 of all years? It's been, I think, almost a year since the last time we sat down for a podcast. Am I right about that?
Yeah, that's nuts. So much has happened this year, Charles. Like, it's unbelievable how much has happened.
You've been busy.
You've been too, which we'll get into that as well. But the Project Patagonia, that was a big experiment that I tried this year. And wow, just like the Rewildology community, it's just, gosh, it's incredible. And I just rounded up the numbers, like thousands upon thousands of downloads between the podcast and the YouTube versions of the series. For those who didn't follow on social media, it was actually a finalist at Jackson Wild, which is, I still am speechless about that. And it was invited and I went to Jackson Wild, which, dude, imposter syndrome. Holy crap. I mean,
the pictures looked awesome.
The people that were there, like, but here's like the thing, since I'm not like from the film world, I didn't even know that who these people were. And then they were like on stage giving their award speeches. And I'm like, oh shit. Like, okay. So that's that BBC group. That's that person. Like the film that won, like that got the Grand Teton Award or something, that's like their highest of highest, is like up for an Academy Award. Like, these are the kind of people that I was there with.
Yeah.
And
that's wow.
It was wild. And I think that it goes to show where media is going. And I hope that a lot of people feel inspired by Rewildology being a finalist for that, because this is the first time that they had opened up a content creator category. And that is what I submitted to. I submitted the Patagonia series to this category. And that's what was a finalist, was the series. Well, overall, they said it was Rewildology, but I had submitted the series. Mm-hmm. And so this is the first time they had let content creators in, which was really cool, which I think that nature, you know, the nature gods, like the nature media gods, whoever they are, you know, the top people that are kind of determine what we consume in the nature media space, is starting to understand or see the power of independent creators. And because, I mean, the other two who were the nominations, who are the finalists in my group, they're just independent people. They didn't represent like an organization. You know, they went out of their way to create a platform and share their passion for nature. Yeah. And I think one got nominated. I think another girl, she submitted and she ended up winning, which is great. Great for her. And then Remodology was the other finalist. It was the only podcast that was there. The only
Holy
one.
Holy smokes.
Yeah. So like wow. I said, imposter syndrome out the freaking roof. And I also found it so interesting too. When I met a few people and they're like, you know, who are you? Everyone was super nice. Don't get me wrong. And then I was like, actually, I'm a finalist. And they were like, whoa. It's like, it's amazing the way people treat you different when you say that. Mm-hmm. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? I don't, it was just interesting since I was a complete outsider to this experience. It was interesting to see how you were welcomed into a community. It did feel kind of like cliquish, you know, since
I totally
didn't really
that.
Know. Yeah, I really didn't know anybody. So I was like, how do I meet people here? And then I like snuck into a barbecue. That was really fun. That was fun. Got into that, like Nat Geo hosted a barbecue and me and my good friend, Michelle, who's an amazing TV editor and is like, come on to Reology's team. We just like snuck in. And got to meet a lot of really cool people, which was fun. But yeah, so that was a huge, just, and I still can't believe it. I have the award somewhere. I need to frame it and put it up. That just has not been a priority.
Absolutely. I was going to ask how much you're allowing yourself to brag on that. Cause that's
I don't brag about it. I don't. It's
got to be on the website. It's got to be all over.
Yeah, it's on the website.
Okay, good.
It is on the website. So yeah, that was huge. And that was just, you know, the audience believing in it and the judging committee who listened to the episodes that I submitted. I mean, the series wasn't even all the way posted yet. Like, I did it on a complete whim, applying to that. And so I couldn't believe when I was a finalist, I about lost my mind. I was in the gym when I got the email and I had to leave before I made a scene because I was losing my mind. It was like, what? I'm a finalist? No. I had to read the email like 3 or 4 times before I was like, this, what? And the series was also featured on Apple Podcasts and they're new and noteworthy under climate. So they have a climate section and it was under the new and noteworthy. So that was pretty cool. So that was that. Amazon. Let me try that again. The Patagonia expedition that is part of Project Patagonia is sold out. So I'm taking 12 incredible people down with me next April to go experience Patagonia. And I'm working on some very incredible conservation experiences with Nico, who we did the big crowdfunder for to raise money for the Blinka project. And right now we're at $1,000 that we've raised. And I'm working with my really close friend, Dave Johnson, at the Katie Adamson Conservation Fund to hopefully raise another $5,000, which we'll give to them on the trip. So that's going to be super rewarding. I'm like, finally, all the reasons why Rewildology exists is like coming together. Like, it was a huge leap of faith, super scary. And I'm still happy that we're able to do things like these. Because, you know, before the show was a weekly interview podcast. And I know that probably some people, when I switched styles, might not have liked it, which I understand. I mean, that was a big shift going from, you know, us having a conversation or me having a conversation with people around the world to a narrative, like a story.
Yeah.
That's a big shift. So I'm glad that we're still able to have these type of conversations and stuff. And now I'm in deep in production of the next series, which is going to be even bigger than that one. Just because I don't know how to do things small. And that one, I just kind of spilled the beans a little bit. It's about the Amazon. I actually, just before we sat down, I've already done an interview today.
You're such a machine. I can't imagine like finishing a podcast interview and then being like, oh yeah, let me go talk to Charles. Like, unbelievable.
Yeah. So that one is probably going to be the most important story that I've worked on, hands down.
Wow. Okay.
It's
jeez.
Yeah. I mean, with depending on how it turns out, it might be the most important story of my career with the people I'm talking to, and the story that's being put together. So yeah, that one, I really hope I do it justice, because these people that I'm chatting with are just so inspirational. I can't believe what they're facing, what they are going against every single day, from, you know, criminal syndicates. Some people are in true danger. The people that they work with are in real danger. And yet there's people who are still getting up every single day and fighting for the Amazon and fighting for their home and fighting to protect this globally important biome.
Like, yeah, right.
This biome is not just an ecosystem. It is literally an entire biome.
That's the holy grail, right, of terrestrial biodiversity. You don't get much bigger or more important than that on land.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm hoping that by the time I'm done with interviews, I'll have around 12 to 15 different voices across 8 episodes, I'm thinking. Potentially not more episodes, maybe more voices, as I feel like any more than that and it might get too long. So that's the tentative plan, and it'll come out Q1 next year. And then working on all the others, so listen, experience, protect. So I'm working on those other two pillars too, the experience. So hopefully, fingers crossed, I can't promise anything since I'm not going to the Amazon. But I hope to also build a trip for that one, like I did for Patagonia. Then we all can go down and meet the people in the series, and then protect us coming together to help fund some really amazing work that's happening there. And
I love that
model. I'm thinking what I might do with this one is, for people who are subscribed to the newsletter, all of us coming together and voting where the money goes. So I'm not going to decide. So I'm going to let the Rewildology community, like, we were able as a community to come together, raise this much money for Amazon conservation. Where do you want the money to go? These are the organizations that we partnered with. Like, where would you want it to go? So I think that's how I'm going to handle that one, because I don't want this. I've never wanted this to be about myself. Never, ever. From starting this. And so this upcoming year, that's a big goal of mine, as to how much more I can help the community, the Rewildology community, and translate listening to action. Like, how can we as listeners do more in an easy way that's accessible, that anybody can do, even if it's volunteering at one of these organizations because they need, you know, to go through camera trap photos, or it's, do you have $5? Like, that's going to help plant a tree in the Araguay biodiversity corridor that I'm hoping to have on the episode in the series too. So, like, little things like that. And then if you're really, really passionate, well, let's go down. Let's go to Peru. Let's go to Brazil. Let's go to these, like, areas and go see it for ourselves. So that's the ultimate goal. And hopefully I will do all of those things and work.
Talk about a New Year's resolution.
Yeah. Dang. So way less episodes next year, but much more impactful. Because, you know, we announced last year in our Nature Happy Hour, that's when we announced the shift.
Right.
That's when we made the big announcement that we were going to this style. And I think it was the right way to go, with all these other things that we're able to do with this series style, I feel like is replicatable in the future. So that's why I made that shift, and it seemed to have worked. So
that was my big question, you know, because you were kind of talking about it as a big experiment, right? Mm-hmm. And so, of course, maybe that's just the science in me, but the scientist in me. But I hear about experiment, I'm like, okay, like, what were the results? How did it turn out? How did you feel about it? You know, but it sounds like you feel really positive, and it's been a great,
The results show it. It was nominated for a major award. Apple Podcasts featured it. Like, we were able to raise money. People are going to be coming down to Patagonia to support the Root of Parks, to support Puma conservation. Cool. Like, that's what it's all about, you know? So I would say that that's a success. Like, the downloads aren't as important as the measurable impact, you know? So I think that that's my reflections on 2025. What about you? You've had so many big papers come out, and
that's yeah. It's been
you've had a lot too.
Now that I think about it, I won't spend too long on it, but yeah, it's mostly been, you know, I think 2025 was really my big year of getting spun up for realsies as a professor, right? And obviously when we first spoke, I was, you know, recovering from chemotherapy and, you know, a stage 2 cancer diagnosis, and I've just been on the mend for the last 12 months, but my health has really come back in a big way, and I've been getting a clean outlook, you know, on my health and scans going well and things like that. So all signs point to, you know, being in remission and being in a good place, which is really amazing. And then of course, yeah, I've been working in this new capacity as an assistant professor at the Ohio School of Ecology, starting my lab, right? Getting research going. I had two new PhD students start this fall, which is really exciting, and one new master's student, although he's really pushing hard and very intense and very excited and doing such good work that he's very determined to switch over into a PhD actually. And for most people, I would say, don't do that. But with his level of kind of competence and how good his research is already going, I'm like, yeah, oh, sure, man. Like, let me just get out of your way, okay? which is really impressive. But yeah, and it's been fun to build this, you know, conservation community in the Wildlife and Water Lab, right? My research group, and to kind of set the tone. And I feel like it's been really exciting this year to see that come together. And it's really becoming, yeah, like a very passionate and hardworking group of conservation biologists who also are just like nice, fun people, you know. And that's kind of what I've been telling everyone, that because I've been interviewing new students for next year, you know, the culture that we're trying to build is like, you know, we get stuff done and we're hardworking folks, but we're also going to be nice people you'd want to have a beer with, and not like, you know, hyper competitive or nasty or egotistical about it, because, you know, inevitably you can run into that, right? Especially in academia. Among my two new students, among my new PhD students, we have some folks with really exciting backgrounds, who are poised to do really, really exciting work. So, one of them, was coming from, World Wildlife Fund, Pakistan. And he was working on montane wetland conservation up in Pakistan. And now he's coming here to do work on nature-based solutions. And we're actually hopefully kind of starting some collaborations with IUCN.
Wow.
To help them build up their kind of global, what they call the global standard around nature-based solutions. So we're talking with them now about how do we make some of those things more robust so that they can really support biodiversity conservation globally. Things like that. And then the other new student coming in for a PhD was working with Wetlands International, which is another NGO I really, really have a lot of respect for. And she was based also in the Himalayas in India. And she has formerly done a bunch of work with snow leopards. It's just, she's hoping to do some work, some very interdisciplinary work, combining some sort of eco-hydrology of glaciers and snow melt and like where the water goes with snow leopard kind of behavior and movements with potential conflicts and changes socially as kind of like economies of tourism develop in different parts of the Himalayas, and how that changes like gender roles and social economic imbalances and things like that. So, yeah, really excited for a lot of the work that's kind of starting to really bubble up. And of course, all the other work that we've been doing along the Missouri River and some of the work at Archbold Biological Station down in Florida, that stuff is all kind of really trucking along and building up. So that's been the biggest thing for me, is just watching these people, these, you know, young professionals really growing and feeling like I can be a good mentor for them, and watching that research start to grow in ways that are going to be really impactful for conservation and ecological knowledge. That's been really rewarding. It's been an insane amount of work. I'm so tired, but But it's been good. And yeah, like you said, it's also been a very good year, I think, just for sort of my really nerdy academic work, just writing papers for academic audiences. So, you know, one of the ones that I'm super proud of, I wrote with some, like, basically role models of mine, right? Like two like of the world's kind of leading freshwater biodiversity conservation scientists. I struck up a conversation with them maybe 2 years ago at a conference, and that became a paper that came out this past year. That was us like really kind of doing a huge review of the literature and of conservation case studies and setting forth what we call the gaps in freshwater biodiversity conservation. What are the things that are missing? Right, because we know that freshwater biodiversity is the most endangered in the world. It's the most in threat. What are we going to do about it? How do we plug the gaps, right, and stop the leak? And that was just a really cool exercise. I learned so much from those people, and having that come out just gave me a big feeling of pride there. So, yeah, that's most of it. It's been a very academically intense year, professionally, and then still kind of like plugging away with Gulo and Nature and trying to like just learn new tools to kind of build up the content there and make those posts better and more informative, getting more input from readers about what else they'd like to see there, which has been cool. One of my favorites recently was I did a post about how to make a nature to go, like nature, what do they call it? A go bag. So like, if you just like, you know, spending time outside, right, is there's always barriers to that. There's always something else to do. You got to do an errand, whatever. But if you make yourself a go bag that just has whatever, some water, some snacks, maybe your nature journal, whatever, and it's just there ready to go, then when you do get that extra hour to like run around outside and go see something cool and like connect with nature a little bit, it's that much easier to do it because you don't have to worry about rounding up all things you need, right? So did a post about, you know, what you should put in a nature go bag and how do you, right, like reduce the starting energy to get out and spend time outside, because there's always little obstacles, and if you let that stuff keep getting in the way, then you don't get that time. And then I guess the latest new thing with Gulo and Nature is I did start a newsletter. So it's a bi-weekly newsletter for the blog, and it, you know, highlights some of the posts that are already out there, highlights the new posts when they come out, and I have like a little wildlife of the week every time where I talk about some other phenomenon in nature or some other animal that might be of interest. It has also nature vocab, so I like look up really nerdy nature words for people to know, and introduce another one of those every week and things like that. So it's just been another nice way to connect with that content and get a little extra information, a little more personal from me. You know, it reflects a lot of my outdoor experiences and things like that. Yeah, so like you said, busy year also, but a lot of fun things spinning up. Mm-hmm.
Isn't it so fun seeing your friends thrive? Isn't it great? Like, I just love it. I love hearing that. I love when we go months without talking because we're both so busy in reaching like our personal goals and passions. And then we catch up. We're like, oh my gosh, we have so much to tell each other.
True. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Like, full disclosure, we were talking a mile a minute for like 25 minutes before starting this podcast. Yeah. Because we had to decide to cut ourselves off and get started, but you know.
Yeah, I mean, I'll totally throw you under the bus right now. We started this by Charles not turning on his mic. I'm like, dude, I can't hear you. And he's just like.
Yeah, you got to work out those kinks, you know.
My mic isn't on. It's like, oh.
It's just a little rusty, you know. It's been a long time since I did a podcast. I'm supposed to be on the Nature Guys again soon, which I'm really excited about. I've been talking about some episodes with Bob and. Yeah, it's been too long since I've done some podcasting. I'm so excited to be getting back on the horse a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. And you even had me come talk to your class. That was so much fun.
That was awesome. That was for a lot of people. So yeah, I was teaching a science communication for ecologists course here at UGA. And I did a short part on, you know, what I was calling sort of modern communication for scientists. So it was podcasting and TED Talks. And we had Brooke come in as a guest speaker, and the students loved it. I was just looking at what do you call them, the course evaluations, and you know, there were quite a few anonymous like, oh, the visiting speakers were so great, like Brooke was so awesome, you know. So I think you made a very big impression on the students.
Yeah. Well, I'm happy to talk to them whenever. Just let me know.
And thank you for doing that. I know that was like, you know, in the middle of a work day and stuff. So I super appreciate it.
Yeah. I thought about that, how fun it would be maybe if I ever come down to Georgia, just like pop into a class and like,
oh, yeah.
I
don't know. Oh, we can make that happen.
That'd be so fun.
Oh, yeah.
Or just do something that's like a little bit more hands on. Yeah, instead of me just like talking virtually through, which was fun. The class asked a lot of really good questions. A lot of really good questions. I think they were surprised by some of my answers since I don't hold anything back. I was like, if you're going to ask me, we're going to go down this path.
That's right.
Like,
that's right. They got real Brooke. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Well, okay. So let's swatch. Let me try that again. Okay, so let's switch gears here. Mm-hmm. So also, what we wanted to talk about today was some of the top headlines from 2025 that really piqued our interest. Because, you know, there's so much that happened this year. It was kind of overwhelming a little bit. Yeah. All the different headlines, good and bad, that happened. And we both decided that we were going to pick a few that we wanted to talk about that piqued our interest the most. I went for Warm and Fuzzy. I think Charles did not go for Warm and Fuzzy, which is totally fine. But yeah, like, which is good. There's a lot happened.
Yes.
In North America, around the world, there's a lot that happened. So why don't you start? What was your first topic or first thing that happened that you wanted to chat about?
Oh boy. Okay. Well, I will first admit that I was somewhat planning on you going first so we wouldn't have to start on too dark of a note. But you know what? If you start at the bottom, you can work your way up, right?
Yes.
So my, and this is perhaps not unexpected, as I think about wetlands all the time, but my major news item that I was focused on were some very recent proposed rules by the EPA that were in response to a big Supreme Court case that happened at the end of 2023 pertaining to the Clean Water Act. And I'm going to try not to get too legal with this, in part because I don't think everyone wants to hear super gory legal details, in other part because I'm not a lawyer and I'll probably say something dumb. But you know, my understanding, right? We know that among the really big policies in the US that protect nature in extremely important ways, right? We have the Endangered Species Act, which by the way is currently under a lot of threat, and there are some proposed rules right now that anyone listening can provide comment on, although the comment period might be over in a couple of days, so maybe not by the time this comes out. But point being, you know, there's a lot of assault on our sort of legal facilities for protecting nature, frankly. The Clean Water Act is one of the really big ones because it allows the federal government to, via the EPA, to essentially have some control over what people can do even on private property. So if it's going to be impacting the waters of the country, right? And their quality and so on and so forth. So one big part of that Clean Water Act is the idea of waters of the United States, what people have very cutely abbreviated as WOTUS. And WOTUS are protected in some pretty big ways because we discovered, you know, in like the early 1900s, what have you, that like we were destroying all of our waters and that was killing ecosystems and that was killing people, right? Like polluted waters are bad. Destroying natural ecosystems is bad. It hurts people. It costs us tons of money to fix. It causes disease. People die. It causes flooding, so on and so forth. So they proposed all these protections for WOTUS. What happened in 2023, there was a case called, I think, Sackett versus the EPA. And that was a family that was trying to build something on their property between their house and a big lake nearby. They were trying to develop something in between. And there were like wetlands between their house and the lake. The lake nobody was questioning that that was WOTUS. It's a gigantic ecosystem, so they're trying to protect that. What the EPA told them was essentially like, you can't build this stuff here because these wetlands are also protected under the Clean Water Act, which indeed was like the interpretation of the original Clean Water Act. The Supreme Court in 2023 basically decided like, no, that's not true anymore. Like, we're going to change the definition of what is a WOTUS. And not to get too technical, but they basically said that it has to be like, it has to be something with a continuous surface connection, and I'm using air quotes here for people listening, to a navigable water, also using air quotes. So basically they were saying like, you know, that drastically restricts what we can consider a WOTUS, what has to do with water. So tons of things are not protected anymore. What's happening now, and this is the same thing where like, I think until January 5th or 6th, it's the open comment period on this. And all the articles I was reading on this were from like last month, from late November. The EPA is proposing this new rule, you know, in response to this, modifying this, which even further restricts these protections for WOTUS, for water things. Talking about the idea of like, well, that connection needs to happen during the wet season. They're removing things like interstate waters as a criterion. So if you have a wetland or some water body that like passes between states, that used to make it a WOTUS and it was protected. Now it doesn't anymore. Things like that. They've also had another, they just described a bunch of other scenarios that disqualify something from being protected. Things that were on prior converted cropland, which means like if you try to restore something, as you know, you put effort into restoring an ecosystem on cropland, well, it still isn't protected anymore, even though you restored it because it's on prior converted cropland, things like that. And that things like groundwater are not protected. So if the water feeding, right. Yes. No, I mean, I agree.
Sorry, just that one took me away. What?
So, I mean, the reason people want this, right? The reason that people are supporting this, and I don't think a lot of people are. I think it's a lot of very powerful people that are supporting this, but not a lot of people, if that makes sense, is because it supposedly lightens the administrative load on farmers, right? The idea is that, like, it's up to them whether they protect something. And it's not the federal government's business, is essentially the idea, right? And I'm going to try not to get too heated or too political here, but that's the reason, that's the ostensible reason why it's being supported. Obviously, as you just pointed out, right, the people who are against it, even at face value, the problems that they're bringing up are like, well, that's not how water works, right? Like continuous surface water connection, like lots of water moves around in ways that have nothing to do with surface water, and that water is still really important. You know, and as we've learned all over the country, especially in our like military bases and things, like groundwater moves around and it's extremely important where it goes, and it's extremely important to protect groundwater. Tremendous numbers of people, including farmers, rely on groundwater to get to irrigate their crops or to drink or whatever else. And not regulating that can be very harmful, right? We can get some very problematic issues here with either depleting that groundwater or having it be unhealthy to drink. So on and so forth, or commercially inviable. And as we know, or at least as a lot of us nature nerds know, right, wetlands are some of the most valuable ecosystems on the planet for providing what we call those hydrological ecosystem services. They purify our water, they improve our groundwater recharge, so we have lots of groundwater to use and it's higher quality, they protect us from floods and so on. There have been now some studies on what the implications of these policy changes are. What I read recently is that it's estimated to be reducing protection or eliminating protection for millions of acres or tens of millions of acres of wetland in the United States. The best case scenario that one group estimates is that 60% of U.S. wetlands are losing protection. The worst case scenario is something like 95%. So, you know, and this is in a country where like we've on average lost probably like 50 or 60% of our wetlands as a nation already, keeping in mind that we only started with something like 5 to 10% wetland cover over the country, you know, when people started colonizing and developing North America or the United States. But so, you know, losing that much of what's already so little is pretty dicey, pretty risky. So that's my like scary news that I've been thinking a lot about. I did intentionally pick my second news piece to like twist that one and give it kind of like a positive spin there. The big thing that like I'm thinking a lot about and what a lot of my colleagues in conservation are thinking about is like, okay, federal protections are essentially gone and they might be getting gouged even worse by this current proposed ruling for the last couple of months. What do we do? What I'm seeing and what people are focusing on now is like, well, what are the states going to do? And there are a lot of states in the country that already have their own laws that can serve this purpose, right? Like Minnesota has a 1991 Wetland Protection Act. There's lots of states that don't.
Especially Minnesota. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
How much water is there? Wow.
But the point is that like now it's going to be in the state's hands. And that means it's just going to depend on who's in charge in those states, right? So some states are probably just going to say, nope, right? And the risk there is like, well, what happens to the people who live there, right?
That's like immediately where I was going. What about the people?
Yeah. Think about like, you know, the crazy power outages in Texas and stuff, right? Like where people were freezing to death and whatever else. Like we know that some policies are not good for people. And then when states decide to go along with that, right, and they have a certain energy structure, a certain whatever, like people get hurt. And also, of course, in this case, like wildlife gets hurt, right? And I think that's my big concern coming out of this year is the fact that this stuff has not only been happening, but now it's really spinning up and becoming official and becoming policy. And what is that going to mean, right, for nature in the U.S.?
So are you seeing... So if those protections are removed, then is the big thing it's going to be open for development, or are farmers not going to need to worry as much about pesticide use? Or I guess what is going to happen? What are the negative ecological things that might happen if these protections are removed?
Yeah, great question there to kind of put it in, you know, very real terms. So something that kind of alarmed me is that the vast majority of wetlands in North America are on private property. So like when we talk about losing so much of our wetlands, it's because, yeah, you know, like only a small amount are in places that we're already protecting. And so in this case, what that means is anybody who wants to build something or who wants to drain a wetland to grow crops there instead, or who wants to discharge harmful materials into a wetland. Again, a wetland that might have groundwater connection with things that we drink from and recreate in. They no longer will need to get permission from federal government to do that, is my understanding. That the controls that prevent them from doing that are going to be gone unless their state or county government can do something about it. Right, unless they have a law. The federal protections restricting those rights of people to do that are going to be gone. I will say, like, a lot of one of the reasons that a lot of the wetlands in the country are on private land is because those are the ones that were protected, and people were not allowed to develop wetlands in their private land, right? So they're hiring consultants to delineate areas and say where the wetland begins and ends, and they leave that area alone, and then they bulldoze the rest, right, and build a new housing complex or whatever. Now, they might not have to do that. They might just say, okay, I'm just going to hire someone to drain it because it doesn't matter. I don't need permission. It doesn't have any surface water connection to a WOTUS or whatever. So I think this means that people have a lot of new flexibility then for them. Maybe it saves them some money, but it means then that they could be polluting these waters that could get to our waters, you know, our more broadly public access waters, and developing, you know, what people like you and I would consider very valuable wildlife habitat, you know, just no questions asked, just bulldoze it.
Wow. Okay. I understand. Yeah, that's heavy, but it's real. We need to talk about these things.
Yeah.
And so if it does come to pass that the protections are limited, then we as U.S. citizens really need to go to our states and tell our state government that this is very important, and it's now reliant on the states,
right,
with to do this protection,
right,
stuff,
right. And there are a lot of states that already do, which is great.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, I mean, because I've
some states
like
are keeping
people.
Their stuff. Yeah. Yeah. So it's all going to depend. I mean, there are some states that, because they saw this happen at the federal level, they're getting rid of their protections because now they're like, no, let's go for it. If the feds don't make us do it, let's just remove all our protections, you know? So wow. Everyone's having a different reaction to it.
Sometimes I'm like, what times are we living in? I don't get it sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I understand. From like a political power standpoint, I understand why some people are much in favor of reducing the amount of federal government like interventions, which I understand because the founding of our country was most of the power is supposed to be in the states. I get that. I understand why some people are, you know, they support that. It's like, so then the states then need to take into account what's best for their people, their populace, their mm-hmm. everybody underneath their protection. I mean, when you talk about water, I'm thinking that now that I'm back in Appalachia and the mountains, the mountain range starts here, like how important it is to protect those areas. And then, of course, when I was out in Colorado, out in the West, that's a whole different set of water issues.
Oh, boy.
A whole different set of water issues. Yeah, that one's hard. That one's heavy. Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah. Okay. I didn't even know this one. I didn't even see that. So, like, right? This is why
it
we have this
get
conversation.
Talked about enough. Yeah, yeah,
no,
yeah.
I didn't know this.
Well, so my question for you then is coming off of this.
Mm-hmm.
Would you rather that I follow into my like next one, which is a maybe slightly like hopeful, warm and fuzzy related thing, or do you want to hit us with like a different warm and fuzzy to cleanse the palate?
I'll go. I'll do a warm and fuzzy.
Let's
because
do it.
It's not going to take long.
Oh, great.
So my warm and fuzzy is just because this never happens today in today's age. Green turtles were downlisted from endangered to least concern by the IUCN in 2025. Can you
green
imagine
green sea turtles?
That? Yeah. Yes.
What?
Yeah. Yeah. So green sea turtles were downlisted from endangered to least concern. We never see this. You never see wildlife have that drastic of a comeback. Yeah, I guess the global population has increased by roughly 28% since the 1970s, following decades of conservation efforts. I mean, of course, there's still some regional areas that are still threatened and vulnerable that we definitely need to keep our eye on to protect. But yeah, just all of this sea turtle work that's been going on for the past decades. I've talked to now several sea turtle conservationists, and just how much dedication and work they've done is finally starting to reap the benefits. Like, we're starting mm-hmm. to see comebacks. I wrote this down too, is that they're a conservation dependent species, because without these interventions, they probably would have been lost. And then it doesn't make sense to say that one without saying the next one is actually some good news from Florida. Can you believe it? We got some good news from Florida. that they had a record-breaking leatherback nesting year. Record-breaking.
Oh, my gosh.
Record-breaking. Yeah, they had, let me see here, 2021 nest recorded for leatherbacks, which is the highest number of leatherback sea turtle nests that have ever been recorded in the state ever. So that's huge because they are critically endangered.
Yeah.
So the fact that, so major milestone for one of the world's largest and most endangered sea turtle species, period. And
that's super exciting.
Yeah. So preliminary nesting turtles. So I got these numbers from the Fish Florida Wildlife Research Center, I think is what it's called, or something like that. So as of August 31st, their numbers were 100,860 nests for loggerhead turtles, 61,708 nests for green turtles, 2,021 nests for leatherbacks, which was the record, 10 Kemp's Ridleys, and then 0 Hawksbill, which, of course, I don't know the comparison to what these should be or not, because Hawksbills are also
Hawksbills are super rare.
Yeah, they're that's also a highly threatened species for the trade. They are targeted for the trades, especially. So really good news about sea turtles. And I actually have an update coming out soon that I'm going to be posting about online, as I reached out to several past podcast guests. I was like, hey, what's your latest update? Can you tell me what's up? You know?
Yeah, you got your whole network now.
Yeah. Gosh, I have a crazy network now. And actually, I'm just going to pull up the email because I want to read specifically from Melania. So,
What episode was Melania from?
Oh, God, I don't remember. But she should look it up. Melania Lopez, so she works in the Yucatan Peninsula doing sea turtle conservation work. But they had a really good nesting year. They had 3,074 hawksbill nests.
Oh, my God.
5,094 green sea turtles, 2 leatherback, and 1 loggerhead. So a very amazing year for them in terms of nests that they recorded and protected. Mm. So that's where all the hawksbill apparently were. They weren't in Florida. They were in the Yucatan Peninsula, so down on the other side of the Gulf. So, yeah, great news from her as well. Yeah, so great news for sea turtles. And then, of course, my next thing also, too, was about the High Seas Treaty. But so, yeah, if you want to go to your warm and fuzzy, sure. Or if, I don't know if it's warm and fuzzy, but on the happy side of that.
Yeah.
Sea turtles. Good year for sea turtles.
I'm really stoked to hear that. I don't remember if you and I ever talked about this, but I mean, that's how I got my start in the conservation world was sea turtle work. My first ever job. Yeah, my first ever job, I was like a 20-year-old idiot, and I like just went to Costa Rica for a summer. I went down there in like late April and stayed there until the end of the summer, working way out in a remote village in southeastern Costa Rica on the Caribbean side, doing leatherback sea turtle work. And, you know, and it was everything from like, you know, taking measurements and monitoring like nesting females when they came up on the beach, to like patrolling beaches for poachers, to building hatcheries so we could protect eggs where the females like laid them in places that we knew were hazardous and stuff like that. I loved it. I mean, really special, amazing animals, terrifyingly large. I mean, leatherback sea turtles are like, it's like watching a VW bug pull up on the beach. It's terrifying. It's a Jurassic Park, you know.
They're huge.
They're huge. They're so big and extremely strong. If you accidentally get in their way, they don't see you and they'll just like wreck you. I saw someone get their legs taken out by one. I don't know. It's really exciting to hear that kind of news, and it makes sense, right? That like it would be kind of a delayed thing, that if we started trying to conserve them in the 70s, that we'd start to see some impacts after 50 years, because how long does it take them to reach sexual maturity? I think it's got to be like 20 or 30 years. I mean, they're very long-lived animals. And so that, you know, what we conservation biologists would call like the demographic delay, right, would be a long time before you actually saw the shift from all the effort we've been putting in. So that is extremely exciting. I mean, in my view, you know, populations like that respond so slowly to things that maybe if we're starting to see an uptick now, that might mean we're in the process of a much bigger uptick that's going to be going on for a while. You know, my question would be like, can we keep it up? Because like, that's great.
Yeah. And all of the work, like, what you just said, the projects like that, where people are going, they're protecting the nest, they're protecting from poachers. Bycatch is a really big issue. And so I know that was a lot of this work too, has been working with fishermen, working with different communities to reduce bycatch, to reduce like consuming turtles. I mean, some people, like, that's part of their culture. So you got to respect that by all means. But for these critically endangered species, I know there's been a lot of education efforts around all this kind of stuff. So we're seeing the the work is paying off. Your work when you were 20 years old, who knows? Yeah. Maybe one of those leatherbacks in nest is still alive today and came back out 16 years later or whatever, and, you know, nested on that beach and are swimming out in sea because you went down there for a summer and helped protect. Isn't that cool to think?
Yeah, it is. It's amazing. Yeah, and it was a phenomenal experience. I learned a lot.
So. Yeah. Okay, what's your next thing?
My next one, also fairly quick. It looks like this has kind of been an ongoing thing, but people are just sort of paying a lot more attention to it right now. So this has to do with, you know, you and I were talking about, like, well, shoot, what do you do when, like, you know, you don't have these federal protections for wetlands or other ecosystems that we want to protect? You know, ultimately, yeah, like, it comes down to, like, the local people sometimes, right? Because they're the ones who are going to be negatively affected by this. They're the ones getting, you know, bullied and pushed around by much bigger economic forces from somewhere else that don't care what happens to that place. So the example is from Ecuador, coastal Ecuador, around a couple of the smaller islands off the coast, where there are sort of traditional economies built around crab fishing, specifically in the mangrove ecosystems. Mangroves, as I'm sure probably a lot of our audience knows, something that's really well communicated to people, mangroves are like rock star wetlands. I mean, they're already wetlands, but they're like, they're good at everything, right? Like they protect people from storms. There's been research in Florida showing that, like, with recent hurricanes that have come through Florida, people who had mangroves on their properties had like several $100,000 less damage and stuff. Just crazy.
Wow.
crazy. I'm sure my numbers are wrong, but, like, you know, just ludicrous benefits from sea level rise, from protection from storms and storm surge, carbon sequestration, just all kinds, you know, biodiversity, productivity, so on and so forth. Ecuador's are, especially in Ecuador, but throughout the region, mangroves are major homes for a tremendous amount of what I would call biomass, right? But lots of living things, like just a lot of stuff. Even if it's, yes, there's a great diversity, but there's also just so much of it. There are so many animals and plants that live in those mangroves. Their productivity of things like crabs and other sources of food is enormous. And so they have these fisheries where fishermen go out and they collect crabs, they fish for crabs in these mangroves. But the rate of loss of these mangroves in, like, the late 1980s through the 2000s was really rapid, because people were cutting them down for development. People were cutting them down for material, and they were also clearing them for shrimp farms. But the shrimp farmers were not really so much local people, right? That was big money coming from somewhere else to make these huge shrimp farms to ship all over the world, you know? And those were destroying not only the mangroves and putting people in danger from, you know, again, storm surge, blah, 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 but then also, you know, affecting the livelihoods of these rural crab fisher people. And so they started, like, forming community groups and getting these, what they were calling concessions, where essentially they, like, work with the government and they get an agreement, like, no, this huge area of mangroves, like, our whole community is going to protect it. And, like, people aren't allowed to come here and cut down our mangroves. People can't start a shrimp farm here. And so these fishermen would, like, go out and do their fishing every day, but they have a whole system where, like, every month you get called on and you and your buddy have to go out in your boat and, like, patrol the mangrove.
Wow.
And so, like, every day or something, there's somebody out there patrolling, and they've drastically reduced the amount of loss. They've, like, established kind of like a, I don't want to use the word ownership, but they've established a stewardship, right, with the community of these mangroves. So it's like they took it into their hands, right? In their case, I think there were some federal protections for mangroves, but they were so far out in the boonies, basically, that, like, the government couldn't enforce it. There was just no capacity. So different than, like, the policy switches in the U.S., but same, where it was like, yeah, the federal government wasn't going to do anything about it. They did it. And now, like, a lot of them are in the process of figuring out, like, oh, like, well, you know, maybe we're going to start getting additional income because people are going to pay us for the blue carbon sequestration that's done with these mangroves, right? The mangroves are extremely good at taking carbon out of the atmosphere and putting it away in, like, you know, wetland anoxic storage for however long. Like, they can get paid for those credits and things like that, right? So it seems like it's just a really, again, a really nice like win for the community, a really nice win for all the biodiversity that lives in those mangroves, and an example of like, yeah, like you know, with the right community leaders and the right organization, maybe they can stand up to some of those larger international economic forces that, whether or not those four, you know, I don't want to like say that like big companies are necessarily malicious or whatever, but regardless of what their attitude is, they're not going to think the same way about those places that they don't live, frankly, right? If you don't live there, you're not going to be as worried about what happens. So, yeah.
Well, that's exciting. And I love hearing stories like that where people take protecting their own resources into their own hands. I love that. Because right. Sometimes I feel like we're so reliant on governments, or we're raised and used to thinking that protecting what matters to us is a government responsibility when it could be ours, you know? So, yeah. I mean, a lot of people with lots of money and private land have taken it upon themselves to restore their land, to protect their wetlands, to do a lot of incredible work on large scales that we don't hear about because it's private, you know?
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. I'm starting to see that a lot now with a lot of the stories that I've told or what I was just up in Yellowstone for that film series I was in, like meeting these people who are doing these things all outside of the Yellowstone National Parks, like Grand Teton and Yellowstone. They work outside of it, and they are the ones that are making incredible things happen, you know? So I love hearing stories like that, you know? I think it should feel empowering that it's like, hey, yes, we can help. We can do stuff.
Right, right. Yeah, I think like partnerships, right, between private and government agencies are kind of like the most important things to have. Like I'm always worried about like people thinking like, oh, well, it should just be up to everyone. And it's like, well, like lots of people don't know what they're doing, frankly. And then also like when it comes to like nature, right, and like the climate and these like huge ecosystem and global biome level stuff, you just can't as a single person change that, right? Like those are things that we need like entire nations to get together to protect. You just can't solve those problems on your own. But I think that we need at the same time, like you're saying, to cultivate that sort of sense of responsibility to do what we can do and to find ways to build what we can do, you know? And then I think that involves both voting and, you know, saying, no, I'm going to protect this wetland just because I want to, not because the government says I have to, you know? I think those two things kind of not only can, but need to coexist.
Yeah. And I think right now, so far, it's in a similar vein, or it's related in a tangent way, mm-hmm. or whatever you want to say. Mm-hmm. I'm in the middle of this big Amazon series, right? And I've not been there. I've only met people who work and live there. And one of my biggest takeaways so far is this greater sense of humanity that I'm feeling right now, that it's not an us versus them. And I don't think I've ever felt this way before. And I didn't name it before, or I didn't realize that this is a feeling I had before, where I didn't know if it was a sense of respect or something, or just like the way being raised in the United States, of this like individualism that we have, like this individualistic culture that we have.
Mm-hmm.
And just talking to so many people from around the world and in the Amazon who are protecting this one biome and the people who live there, like indigenous. Another thing that I also learned too, the vast majority of people who are from the countries in the Amazon have a high percent of indigenous DNA in them. So they're like, this is just as much ours as anything. And so I was like, wow, you know, you're right. And the more I thought about it, I'm just like, this greater sense of humanity that sometimes I feel like we have forgotten, that just because I am in the United States or somebody is somewhere else, we are all the same species. And this is all our shared planet. And I am allowed to love these ecosystems just as much as I love my own, and vice versa. And others are allowed to love the ecosystems that I live in and try to protect all the time just as much. Like, this is our, we are a shared, we are all attached. We are all humans. Like, and I don't know why this realization is just hitting me now so hard, but I can't get over this feeling of, like, not that it was a very much a them problem, or it was like us versus them. It was like, you know, I was trying so hard. I built this platform to highlight these other voices of these people working in other areas and protecting, like, their natural resources and all this stuff. And then I'm just like, it's ours. It's not just theirs. It's ours. This is our planet. Like, this is our home. And this is my first time I've actually said any of this out loud, which is why I'm not really articulating it really well, because I'm still working through these emotions. But it wasn't until this series that I had this, like, light bulb moment of the Amazon. Not, I don't want this to come off the wrong way, because this is not what I mean. It's like, the Amazon is just as much important to me and my health and my sense of well-being as it is to everybody, because we are all dependent on it being a thriving ecosystem.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's what that reminds me of just a group of people coming together to protect what they feel is theirs and what's right, because it's their home and it's their mangroves, and somebody else's need and greed is going to destroy what is rightfully not only theirs, but everybody's. It's like this wonderful mangrove ecosystem that is doing so many great things for humanity and oceans and biodiversity and all of this stuff. Like, and us as scientists, I've come to learn, we put too many labels on things. It's like, just life, like, just the life that is there. Like, why do we have to label everything? I'm trying to use way less jargon, and it is really hard.
It is extremely hard.
When you are a trained scientist, it is so hard to stop using jargon. Yeah. And I'm just like, why? Like, people are being deterred from our messaging just because we're using words that they don't understand. It's like, gosh, dang, I got to stop doing that. So that's been that's another big goal of mine in 2026. Less jargon.
Ooh.
And it's hard.
Yeah.
But,
talk a lot about that in the science communication course.
Yes. Yeah. And so, like, all the social media posts moving forward, I'm trying to, like, remove jargon. I want more people to feel included in this and stuff like that. Like,
Yeah,
that was a tangent I didn't expect to go down, but
that sounds like our next coffee hour to me. I'm not kidding. I think there's a lot to unpack there in a really cool way. I know we've got all kinds of ideas floating around, but I'm going to say this might be one for us to think about, that broader topic.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if it's like some spiritual, we might be going into that, like, spiritual awakening that I had recently, or I don't know what it is. I mean, some people who are religious are on the, maybe it's because, you know, I'm talking to this shamanistic cultures. I don't know, but I don't know. I've gone through a lot of just personal growth in this past year, and then doing this series solidified this. I don't know. And if someone's listening, they're like, Brooke, what the hell are you talking about? I completely understand why you might feel that way. And then
I think I am more sold on the Amazon series now. Think about that. Think about that, right? If you see a trailer for some movie and someone's like, making this movie changed my life, I'm like, well, I'm going to see that then. Are you kidding? Like, I want to see you go for through a transformative experience. That's crazy.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry. That's my plug for it.
That's how I'm feeling right now. It's like, I don't understand why this series is making me feel this greater sense of connection with humanity. But it is. It is. And I'm really excited to see how it turns out and how much more growth I experienced through this. Or maybe this was the big message I needed out of this too, is this greater sense of humanity. And that this is our planet and people have the right to live as they are, where they are, and protect the area that they live in. And I don't know how we stop greed, this natural thing that is obviously a part of humanity. Like, how many times have big powers collapsed? You know, how many times has greed outpaced the resources that an ecosystem can provide? And ultimately, nature won because the people collapsed it. How many cultures that we don't even know about that have existed have essentially killed themselves from greed? Mm-hmm. And wow, I did not expect to get all philosophical, but here we are.
Hey, this is coffee hour, right? I told you the vibe was going to be different today.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, and somehow coffee is leading us to that, whereas beers led us to, I forgot what we were talking about before that. Like, anyway.
Do you remember my mandrel joke?
Yes, there it is. There it is. Beers lead to mandrel jokes and learning about Brooke's taste in men.
Yes.
And coffee leads to a deeper connection with humanity. I'm not saying that one of those is better than the other, but like, you know, maybe we should just label these as happy hours versus coffee hours so the listeners can choose what vibe they're looking for that day, right?
Yeah. Are we just like going to have philosophical, like, personal development conversations or just talking about like Brooke's dating life?
You know, you can appeal to a wide audience that way.
Okay, let's go back to the topic at hand. So,
yes, did you have another warm and fuzzy for us? Yeah.
Yes, I do. So the first one that I was going to touch upon, or like the next one, my second one, I'm actually waiting for the Amazon series because this one deserves a full humongous deep dive, because if this goes through, this could change the future of the way conservation and biodiversity is protected. It's called the Tropical Forest Forever Facility, and it is a funding model. I don't want to get too much in this, but it's basically a way to reward countries who protect their forests in the Amazon basin financially. So this isn't anything that normal people can invest in. I actually looked into that. It's a big, it's like $125 billion dollar investment fund, essentially. And yeah, an innovative global financing mechanism launched by Brazil. They need a lot of capital to get this started. Anyways, it could be game changing if this actually happens. I mean, like, literally game changing, because one of the biggest reasons that we are losing so much of our natural resources is because it is worth more harvested and degraded than protected and thriving. Yeah. So this particular investment funding model could change that. And I'm going to do a very deep dive into this in the Amazon series because it is very important. That was going to be my second thing. Okay. So I teased it. We will get into that in the series. So I can do like the full deep dive into that. My other one is we're just staying salty today. We're just staying with the salty ecosystem today.
Yeah.
The High Seas Treaty was passed this year, or I don't want to say passed. It was adopted. So it was formerly known as, listen to this, the Agreement on the Conservation and Sustainable Use of Marine Biological Diversity of Areas Beyond National Jurisdiction. The BBNJ agreement.
Yeah, that's a mouthful, but when you actually say it out loud, I'm like, you know what? That's spot on. I love the sound of that.
Yeah, so now it's called the High Seas Treaty. I think they were like, this is way too freaking long. So it was originally adopted in June 2023 after nearly two decades of negotiation, but in 2025 was a big breakthrough year when it achieved the critical threshold for entry into force. So what it does is it covers the high seas, which is nearly two-thirds of the ocean, which is beyond like any country's national jurisdiction. So it is like the middle of the ocean, about 50% of the Earth's surface. And it established a legally binding framework to protect marine biodiversity in that massive area. So it created marine protected areas and international waters, required environmental impact assessments for activities like deep sea mining or shipping, shared benefits of marine genetic resources from like deep sea organisms used in medicine or biotech, and building capacity in transferring technology to developing countries. This massive ratification push was pushed at the UN Ocean Conference in France in June. A massive wave of ratifications occurred, 18 new countries on the first day alone, bringing the total to 49 countries who are in a part of this treaty. So huge. On September 19th, Morocco became the 60th country to ratify, joined by others like Sierra Leone, triggering the treaty's entry into force 128 days later, which will be January 17th, 2026. This will officially go into practice. So in a couple weeks, which is very exciting. So let's see here. Current status as of December right now, over 70 to 80 countries have ratified, which is more than expected, which is great. Related wins, the treaty supports the global 30 by 30 goal, which protects 30% of oceans by 2030. And global marine protection rose to around 9.9% with new national marine protected areas contributing. Let me see if there's any other really important notes here to bring it up. Tainui. So at the UN Ocean Conference, French Polynesia's president, I cannot pronounce his name. I'm just going to butcher this, but I'm going to try. President Moitai Brotherson announced the expansion of the Tainui Atia. I'm so sorry if anybody knows how to speak Polynesian. I'm just butchering that. Turning nearly all of French Polynesia's waters into a protected zone, which covers 4.5 to 4.8 million square kilometers, roughly the size of Mexico or the EU, making it the largest marine protected area on Earth. So, really big wins for high seas protections. That is huge to have that many countries who have come together to protect the high seas from deep sea mining, from all of these different things, or if these things are, you know, these big projects are put into place, then it's going to have to go through the treaty. So that's just so exciting. How much of our oceans have been just devastated by these, we know the deep sea trawling, all this stuff, all this unregulated water where we know all this illegal activity is happening. Now there's a major treaty that's like, we as, again, our global community is coming together to protect the ocean.
Yeah.
So I was so excited about that. When I read more about this treaty, I was like, this is huge. This is huge. In one of the episodes that I did, I think it was with Chanel Hassan, she gave this great quote. It's like, if you don't have blue, then you don't have green. Speaking to the oceans. If you don't have any blue, if our oceans are dead, then our land is dead. It's not, they're not two different things. Our oceans are directly relate, like they directly contribute to the health of our terrestrial land, and vice versa. So that was my second great thing.
That's so good. I always forget the number, but I think it's something like more than half of the oxygen we breathe comes from, you know, tiny little bacteria in the ocean.
Oh yes. Allison Kusick came on Phytoplankton. She talked about that, where like every other breath you take was produced by little microorganisms in our oceans.
Right, right.
People literally think like, every other breath.
Yeah, and like
not trees. It's not,
right. if those ecosystems go bad, it's not like we're gonna be okay because we don't live in the ocean, right? It's not just gonna be like Atlantis that's in trouble, right? Like we're not gonna be able to breathe. We literally won't be able to breathe. If the oceans go away, like it's not
exactly
negotiable. It's not like a cute thing that we're keeping because it's nice, right? Like,
no,
the oceans are part of how the planet functions. Anyway, I'm delighted by that news. Yeah, that's with all this stuff about, you know, the new technologies for mining the bottom of the ocean for like metals to make smartphones and stuff. It's good to know that those places are no longer going to be such a gray area. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, I also agree. Yeah, and I have a whole bunch of that too that I we have so many topics that we need to discuss. Jesus. I've done a lot of research into like the cradle to cradle model.
Yeah. Well, we'll have to add them to the document I sent you.
Yeah.
Our old list from 23, we can build that back up.
Yes. Wow. Yeah, there's like so many things that I've personally been like diving a lot into. Like I said, this like systems thinking. Been reading a lot of books about that. Cradle to cradle instead of cradle to death, you know, cradle to, you know. So this like whole circular way that the world naturally operates, and like how can we, instead of things being linear, how can things be circular? So that's a whole different topic that can get into at a different time, but sweet. I've been doing a lot of research into that too and trying to understand how we can ensure that the generations after us have a thriving life.
Yeah,
because that's really important.
Absolutely.
Even though we don't have kids, you know. Yeah. Other people have kids.
Right.
Maybe one day.
Yeah. Well, you know, and you don't have to have your own to be like, I want people to live nice, sustainable lives. I don't want, you know, I have, you know, like a ton of my friends back in Boston have had kids in the last couple of years. And like, mm-hmm. I've got my wonderful sort of like secular goddaughter who's now like turning 3. And like, I don't want the oceans to die by the time she's my age. I want her to be able to breathe and have nice air. Or like, heck, I want her to be able to eat a lobster because I'm a New Englander. Like,
yeah.
But if we destroy the oceans, she won't get to have a lobster. She won't get to whatever. Like, you know, so she's not my kid, but I'm still like, dang, I don't want people to have it worse off than I did.
Right. Know? Yeah, completely agree. I have a lot of nieces and nephews, so and eventually one day, I'm sure I'll kind of sort of settle down. Question mark.
Just out there like giving nature tours with like a...
Actually, I could see me doing that. What are you talking about? Like, baby strapped to my back. Like,
hell yeah.
Let's go through the jungle.
Get a good like adventure backpack.
All right, Charles, is there anything else that you wanted to talk about today for the end of the year?
No, I'm feeling pretty good. I've got all sorts of other stuff for our next chat, you know, but I feel like this is a wonderful way to close out the year and or start the next one, depending on when we decide this goes out. Yeah. And yeah, I can't thank you enough for the opportunity. It's actually, now that I think about it, really neat that we got to kind of start the year with an episode and end the year with an episode. I love that.
Yeah, exactly it, because that one came out the end of January, because that's when I announced the big shift.
Yeah, of course
I'm going to announce all my big things with chatting with you, of course.
Yeah, I love that. It's really a privilege.
Awesome, Charles. Well, thanks again. We will sit down soon for a big update in 2026. We'll see what happens and go from
sounds
there.
Really good to me.
Awesome. Thank you for joining me on this wild adventure today. I hope you've been inspired by the incredible stories, insights, and knowledge shared in this episode. To learn more about what you heard, be sure to check out the show notes at rewildology.com. If you enjoyed today's conversation and want to stay connected with the Rewildology community, hit that subscribe button and rate and review the show on your favorite podcast app. I read every comment left across the show's platforms, and your feedback truly does mean the world to me. Remember, rewilding isn't just a concept, it's a call to action. Whether it's supporting a local conservation project, reducing your own impact, or simply sharing the knowledge you've gained today, you have the power to make a difference. A big thank you to the guests that come onto the show and share their knowledge with all of us, and to all of you Rewildology listeners for making the show everything it is today. This is Brooke signing off. Remember, together we will rewild the planet.